Atwater, Fixin' to Die, by Robert Myers, starring Gregory Itzen, directed by Richard Masser, recorded before an audience by LA Theatre Works. Gregory Itzen portrays the brilliant but flawed Lee Atwater, a self-styled master of negative campaigning and a tightly wound country boy from South Carolina who rose to the chairmanship of the Republican Party. And now, Atwater, Fixin' to Die.
I'm looking fun in my eyes now. Leave, I'm fixin' to die. Leave, I'm fixin' to die. I'm looking fun in my eyes.
I once read something about acting which I apply to politics. The most important thing is honesty. Once you can fake that, you got it made. My first experience with politics was in 1967 when I was a junior in high school in Forest Acres, South Carolina. I made up this candidate named Dewey P. One, and I got him elected on a platform of free beer in the lunchroom, unlimited cuts, and no grade lower than a B. He won big, too, over 70% of the vote. And when the principal found out, he threw out the results and he banned me from all future elections. But I didn't really care, since the only things that interested me were girls and music. Blues, rock and roll, rhythm and blues. Roots music. I love that really raw southern black sound from Memphis and Muscle Shoals, Alabama. That stuff on Stax, Sam Moore, Carla Thomas, B.B. King, Otis. I wasn't what you'd call a model student in high school. My own mom, who was a Spanish teacher, gave me a D-. No hablo el español muy bien, if you know what I mean. When I graduated, she managed to get me into Newberry, which is right up the road from Forest Acres. It's not a bad school, but Yale, it certainly ain't. The people, at least, were normal. You could tell the boys from the girls, and we preferred Colt 45 to Panama Red. There weren't a whole lot of marches against the war, either. Now, college had never really been in my plans. I toyed with the idea of becoming a professional wrestler. But what I really wanted was my own band. When I was 17, I went on tour with a rhythm and blues group called the Upsetters Review, making $200 a week, which was big money for a kid in high school. And we played fraternity parties and wedding receptions and convention centers and a few juke joints out in the swamp somewhere. It was a kind of a white boys version of what they call the Chitlin Circuit down here. I played rhythm guitar, and they let me sing a little. We backed up the Drifters, and Lee Dorsey, and Percy Sledge. You remember him? When a man loves a woman. Yeah. This is for you, darling, this hanky here. It's got my own perspiration on it. I want you to take that home now, sugar. In the summer before I graduated from Newberry, my mama got me a job in Senator Thurman's office. Those 3 months in Washington made me realize I had to get serious about my life. Every time I opened my mouth, people looked at me like I was something straight out of the Beverly Hillbillies. So I made a vow to read 2 mind-improving books and run 50 miles per week. I read Look Homeward, Angel, and Plato, and The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which I loved because I thought, hey, this could be my story. That was when I first discovered The Prince by Machiavelli, the best book ever written about politics, since it's really just a study of human nature. Men judge more according to their eyes than their hands. Everyone sees what you appear to be. Few touch what you are. And The Art of War by Sun Tzu, the best operational guide for running political campaigns ever written, since it's a general's manual of military strategy, and politics is really just a form of low-level warfare. All warfare is based on deception. Hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. Hold out baits to entice the enemy, feign disorder, and crush him. Later on, those books became my campaign manuals. I carried them with me everywhere, or at least the Cliff Notes. Now, I learned a lot from Senator Thurman, too. Now, that's a great man, a great American. He was the first Democrat in the South to change parties when he supported Barry Goldwater in 1964. I remember once We were driving together in a car in Miami during the Republican convention in 1972, and all of a sudden we saw this huge demonstration, all kinds of cops and signs and shouting, and some of the kids recognized him in the car, and somebody yelled, "Hey, it's Strom Thurmond, the power pig of the South." Now, we couldn't move, and I thought, oh, God, no, we're dead. But Thurmond decides to get out of the car and talk to these people. And there's TV cameras all over the place. And this 18 or 19-year-old girl confronts him and starts calling him a fascist pig and a cocksucker and all sorts of stuff. And the whole time, Thurmond is just smiling for the cameras, saying, "Little girl, your parents know you're out here? You sure are a pretty little thing." Now, the girl is still cursing at him, and he gets back in the car, and we drive away. And I say, "Jesus, Senator, what were you doing out there?" And he says, "Young man, you see those cameras? We just picked up 25,000 votes. Senator Thurmond was also the one who convinced me that the shift of white Democrats to the Republican Party in 72 was permanent. And he was right. That's one reason I decided to work for the Republicans. I became national president of the campus Republicans, and I met George Bush in 1974 after Nixon made him head of the party during Watergate. He was the one who introduced me to my wife, Sally. He and Barbara even lent me his boat to take her on a date on the Potomac. Now, the other reason I decided to work for the Republicans is because I'm a born rebel. And where I come from, the Democrats are the establishment party. At least they were. Now, when I started managing campaigns in South Carolina, a Republican candidate had a slightly better chance of getting elected to Congress than a three-legged jackass did of winning the Darlington 500. But I decided I was going to change all that. I lost the first two statewide elections I managed, but I learned one thing. Republicans, at least in the South, don't get elected by talking about issues. You have to make the case that the other guy, the Democrat, is an untrustworthy son of a bitch. In 78, when the economy went sour under Carter, I finally began to catch my stride. I appreciate you coming, Mr. Sprouse. I'm sorry about the hour, but we've come across some information which might be useful to your candidacy. Well, we just feel that Republicans have got to be willing to extend a hand of friendship to work with independents if we're ever going to break the Democratic stranglehold. I know, sir, it's not your normal way of doing business, but I don't usually schedule strategy sessions in supermarket parking lots either, but what we have here is pretty sensitive stuff. I just want to be sure that no one misinterprets our meeting, since I'm an advisor to the Campbell campaign on an informal basis, of course. So technically, we are on different sides in the race. Good. I'm glad that we see eye to eye on that. Now, the conventional wisdom is that our Democratic opponent, Max Heller, is the perfect candidate. He's attractive, articulate, the most popular mayor in the state, and that's why he's leading us by 10 points and you by 20. But according to a poll I've just seen, he's got one fatal flaw. No, sir. No, when we asked voters if they cared that he was foreign-born, they didn't bat an eye. The question didn't even register. But when we asked if they would knowingly vote for a candidate who didn't accept Jesus Christ as his personal savior, bingo. 60% of the voters in this district said never. Well, what it means, Mr. Sprouse, is the only way you're going to win this race is to attack Max Heller for not being born again. I know he's Jewish. But the beauty of this strategy is you don't even have to bring Jewish up.
And in South Carolina's 4th Congressional District, Republican Carol Campbell has defeated Democrat Max Heller and Independent Charles Sprouse in a three-way race marked by charges of anti-Semitism.
Come on in, gentlemen. Make yourselves comfortable. Let me offer you some refreshments. Oh, yes, we would certainly be interested in your support. Now, as you know, Governor Reagan is a strong opponent of racial discrimination, and he's been working day and night trying to reach out to you in the black community, which holds a very special place in his heart. Unfortunately, that may be a problem. As you may or may not know, our campaign has a severe shortage of cash. Any candidate who's going to stand up and call for an end to the bloated federal bureaucracy is going to find himself up against a mountain of special interest money. To put it to you quite bluntly, gentlemen, the Reagan campaign is broke. We're just not in a position now to fund your black voter registration drive. And I want you to know that it hurts me more than it hurts you. You know, you might consider speaking to some of John Connolly's people. I know for a fact that the governor has built up quite a war chest, and I'm sure that he would probably love to get the support.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?